Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Economic hard times are forcing many Americans to worry about where their next meal may come from. A city designer from Davenport, Iowa, believes one solution to help feed the hungry and ease concerns about food safety is urban farming. In a new book, Darren Nordahl explains how citizens working with city officials and taking advantage of existing public land can provide healthy, low or no-cost food to the public. Darren Nordahl joins me in the studio. I do invite your calls. I'm sure many of you have seen public spaces being used to grow plants, food, whatever, in your own areas, and you'll call and share with us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And don't forget, you can join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Darren. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
Explain what you mean by public produce.
Well, it is addressing the issue of food security in America, which is tenuous, Diane, right now. It's not just the urban poor who are struggling to find money for meals. We have an obesity problem in America and a diabetes problem in America.
That seems the opposite
exactly.
of what you're talking about.
Yeah, it seems difficult to imagine that we would have too many calories, and that would be a food security issue in a country. But that is exactly what we are noticing here. And the issue is we're consuming an abundance of processed and fast foods, snack foods, and junk foods, and we're not getting the vegetables and fruits that we need in our daily lives. And it affects people who are middle class and even wealthy, and of course even the urban poor. So the idea is one issue that we can look at in addressing food security is underutilized public space. And there's a lot of it in every city. Street medians, flood easements, utility easements, parks, plazas, the landscape grounds around our libraries, our schools, our courthouses, our city halls that are typically being used entirely with the ornamental plants. Cities and city officials are now looking at using edible plants in those public spaces to feed the people.
But it seems as though you'd have to have some controlling mechanism if you began growing that kind of edible produce in public spaces. Who's going to say, you can have this and you can't have that?
Well, and that is the beauty of public produce, and of course maybe its pitfall, is that it is available to the public. What we do notice with community gardening efforts is that even though these community gardens are supposed to be for the community and are often grown on public land, they are grown and harvested as if they were private. Mm. And you'll see a lot of community gardens with fences around
right.
them, padlocks
exactly.
on them. Produce is very valuable, Diane, and people want to get in there
sure.
and get their fresh fruits and veggies. That shows the demand that we have in this country for fresh produce. The idea is that if it was more plentiful and more abundant in our cities, there wouldn't be the need to enclose community gardens with fences and padlocks. That hopefully a lot of the people pilfering the veggies will have other sources to get their fresh fruits.
How did we reach this point of a food shortage in cities today?
Well, a lot of it has to do with the aggregation of farms. And ever since World War II, we've been on a nation seeking to industrialize and commercialize the farming efforts. From World War II, we had about 6 million farms. Today, we only have about 2 million farms. And the smaller farms have been aggregated into larger farms. And the farming operations have become more specialized. States aren't growing an abundance of grains and produce anymore. They're typically picking one cash crop or two cash crops. And as these farms are getting bigger, and more specialized, they need lots of land, and that land requires remote locations. And ever since World War II, those farms have been moving further and further away from the cities, to the point now where even farmers' markets, because of the urbanization, even farmers' markets in some of these areas, those farms are still an hour and a half, a two-hour drive from the city center. So we're trying to find ways that we can bring agriculture back into the cities, something that was done for centuries. Up until recently.
Darren Nordahl, his new book is titled Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I gather you're not just talking about serving the urban poor.
The demand for local produce is very strong. It used to be that we demanded organic produce, and we didn't really care where it came from. We could buy organic pumpkin seeds from China, and we were happy because they were so-called organic. But the organic movement is now seeding to the buy local movement, and we can't seem to satiate this hunger for local food. Restaurateurs who have very, for the most part, their clientele can afford a variety of food options. They demand fresh local food, and nothing can be more local than that food that is grown in those spaces that you pass by daily on your way to work or school or commerce or education or worship.
Of course, there are a lot of farmers in this Washington area, more in Maryland, Virginia, who do bring their produce in to Washington. But they're not going in those densely populated
areas. No, and that is the fact of a capitalistic society, is that the farmers' markets, which are a business enterprise,
you go where the money is.
And the economically depressed neighborhoods, which tend to be in the inner city, they are not locating there. And neither are the supermarkets. And so there's a dearth of food options in these inner cities. We call them food deserts, where the only food available is fast food and convenience food, the junk food that, of course, makes us obese and contributes to a lot of dietary illnesses, such as diabetes, stroke, and certain types of cancer. So the idea is that as long as farmers' markets are following the money, we need to provide options for the people that can't afford the farmers market produce.
Tell me how this idea has been used in some areas around the country.
It really began when I was in Berkeley, and of course they are a very liberal community in Berkeley, where people really pride themselves on fresh food. And I've seen orange trees, figs, tomatoes, grapevines, all sorts of produce being grown in that space between the sidewalk and the curb of the street.
The sidewalk?
Yes.
And the curb.
And you would think that that would be an inhospitable environment for produce. But plants are remarkable, Diane. They challenge every obstacle that you seem to throw at it and thrive and survive. But what I noticed when I moved to Davenport, Iowa, is that public officials we're realizing how much underutilized land is under municipal control. And people are starting to actually use that underutilized land for produce. Most of these were gardening enthusiasts, but they began to understand that it had a greater good besides just the hobby of gardening. And they started offering their produce for passersby.
Just for passersby?
Just for passersby. And then City of Des Moines, as one example, began to address the issue of food security by actually incorporating mini programs. They have gardens at battered women's shelters and churches, at schoolyards. They've even done an edible street plan in one troubled neighborhood where they have fruit trees punctuating the corner, raised vegetable beds between the sidewalk and the curb. They even have a nut and a fruit tree orchard along the edge of a parking lot, taking a blighted piece of property and turning it into something that's not only aesthetically beautiful, but also nourishes our body as well.
And the fact of the matter is that these plants or trees grow to health. They're not destroyed along the way.
No, there are some plants that, of course, will do better in urban environments than other plants. In Davenport, Iowa, where I work, we've tried a variety of produce options. We've had a tough time with some tomatoes and pole beans, and everyone wants to grow tomatoes. That's kind of the symbol of local produce, and that might be the one plant that we best leave to the farmers.
It's very difficult
to grow tomatoes. I've been gardening for many, many years, and I still can't grow a great tomato. But other plants like okra and eggplant, all sorts of leafy greens, corn, root vegetables, they do surprisingly well in urban soils.
I must say, I live in an area just across from a 35-acre plot of community gardens, mm-hmm. and they're precisely as you described earlier. They're fenced in. There are locks on mm-hmm. each plot. There are people waiting for years to have one of those community gardens, but they're all for private use.
Yeah, they don't really benefit the community. And community gardens will eventually be in this frame of public produce, and I mentioned this in the book. Community gardens will probably represent the bulk of the fresh fruits and vegetables that are grown, but we also have to understand that gardens that are grown and harvested and maintained as if they were private do little to serve the community as a whole.
Darren Nordahl, his new book is titled Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture. We'll take just a short break. We've got lots of callers waiting. When we come back, we'll go to the phones. And if you've just joined us, writer Darren Nordahl is with me. He's written a new book titled Public Produce, all about what he calls the new urban agriculture, using public spaces to grow good, nutritious, healthy food to be distributed to people within those communities. And joining us now by phone from Des Moines, Iowa, is Teva Dawson. She's horticulture inspector for the city of Des Moines. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Greetings from Iowa.
And Teva, I gather you are in Darren Nordahl's book. What are some of the urban agriculture programs you're trying in Des Moines?
The Parks Department runs a community garden program where we assist a variety of community groups from schools to community centers and neighborhood associations in the development of, you know, the traditional kind of community gardens. And we help with technical assistance just in the how to go about doing it, but also land acquisition. Several of them are on city property. And we've also hold classes for kind of the basics in gardening, which is kind of a missing component here in our community. It's just learning from, you know, square one, how to grow a vegetable garden.
So who do you think these programs serve most of all?
You know, a lot of times we assume they're serving low-income folks, but we see a huge variety of folks that are in our gardens, people who are living downtown who want to be able to keep their hands in the earth, people who just live in old neighborhoods who have shady backyards. It's a huge variety of folks that we're serving, and I wouldn't say there's even one population. We also, I think Darren alluded to a project we did starting back in 2003 called our Digging Deeper Project, where we developed some edible landscape sites kind of beyond the traditional idea of community gardening. And we took nine locations, a city park, a couple of schools, a shelter, a food pantry, and essentially landscaped their whole grounds with edible plants, fruit trees and nut trees and berry bushes and grapevines and all sorts of great perennial plants. So we kind of went beyond the idea of just each summer having to go through the laborious process of planting a vegetable garden and having them have these wonderful fruit trees on their property that was not only beautifying their grounds in a way that they couldn't afford to even buy a simple tree, let alone a fruit tree. And so that was a really key project for us, I think, in addressing some food security issues in the central city.
But then who maintains those gardens, Teva?
Each of those sites is up for, they need to do the long-term maintenance of them. But, you know, with the fruit trees, as opposed to a vegetable garden, even if you don't prune a fruit tree or spray it, as long as someone's not mowing it down, that tree just produces fruit. You know, so once those trees are established after that first year, they're really resilient. And you may lose a few here and there or one year have some problems with some pests, but by and large, I think they're going to produce a lot more than what you're going to see coming out of a vegetable garden.
And then one final question for you. What about distribution? How do you manage that?
Each one takes care of it on their own. A food pantry is going to operate in terms of giving it away to the public. A city park is just there for folks who walk through the park and want to harvest it. But a school is going to obviously use it to distribute it to their students.
This is such good news.
Isn't it?
And I'm so glad to hear about it. Teva Dawson, she's horticulture inspector for the city of Des Moines. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Diane.
Okay. And here's an email from Julie, who's in Salt Lake City. She's in the Salt Lake County Mayor's Operations Open Space and Urban Farming Program Manager. She says, "Wow, what serendipity. I just found your book when I attended the Land Trust Alliance Conference in Portland. It's truly amazing." She says, "I've just been directed by our mayor and county council to begin an urban farming program that's going to have three components: community gardens, commercial farming, and biofuel. All aspects of the program will be on public county-owned land. We're very excited."
That's very inspiring.
Isn't that terrific?
And cities across the nation are doing that. You know, Mayor Newsom of San Francisco, he just ordered all of his city departments to audit city-owned land, and not just the landscape grounds, but the rooftops of civic buildings, and assess their potential for gardening.
Now, I've heard about rooftop gardening being assessed in New York City as well.
Yeah.
And people painting their rooftops white when there are rooftops, but then using those rooftops as gardens.
Absolutely.
How much effort does that take?
It does require some considerable effort.
Yeah.
But there is, City of Chicago, they have an apiary, a honeybee colony on top of their city hall. And they're able to harvest that honey and sell it back to the community. And that's one way to offset some of the maintenance costs and construction costs of an endeavor like that.
Here's another email, this one from Inga. She says, "I'm an advanced master gardener from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I recently moved to Albion, Michigan, an impoverished community about 50 miles west of Ann Arbor. It's long been a dream of mine to start an organic herb farm with a target market of local restaurants. I've had difficulty acquiring good organic land until I recently bought my first city lot from the county at a tax-reverted land auction. Explain that.
That's amazing. One of the restaurateur business, restaurateurs are very, very hungry for fresh produce, and they need to be able to have land close at hand so that they can grow their own produce. And what cities can do is not only allow restaurateurs to grow their produce on land, but begin to procure some of those sites and actually clean it up. There is some issues that city sites might have some potential contaminations. One way that city officials can support this idea of public produce is to purchase land or set aside land and do any sort of remediation or get it to that organic state, like Inga is talking about, and then turn it over to people like Inga or other departments or the restaurateurs themselves and use that for gardening.
All right, let's hear what some of our callers have to say. We'll go first to Indianapolis. Good morning, Renee. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi there.
So glad you took my call. I wanted to tell you and the listeners, actually, to kind of challenge schools in our country to include urban gardening in their beautiful school lands. Our school is right on a river which runs through the middle of Indianapolis. And we have a lot of homeless people who live along the river, under the bridges, and very close to our school. They're our neighbors. And our students were concerned about how they would eat when we weren't in school. During school, sometimes we would take our extra oranges and apples and fruit and things like that, things that were packaged to them, so they had food. But the students were really worried about them eating while we were gone on summer break. So I decided to help the students by starting a garden. The garden is in raised boxes, so the soil is not contaminated. We got some help. I'm not a farmer or a gardener, so I elicited some help from others, some of the other teachers, some other people in our community who are good gardeners. And so we started a garden, and we put a big sign up that said, "Welcome to our peace garden. Help yourself." And we were so thrilled when we would see things missing. We'd go out, we'd check after school, it was an after school program with the students, and we'd check and we'd say, "Oh, look, our tomatoes, we have tomatoes that are gone, or our beans are being picked." And it just made them feel so good. It also taught the kids, and I'm talking kindergarten through 12th grade, our school is a K-12 school in downtown Indianapolis. So we were teaching the children how to garden in their own homes, and so many of them would come back and say, "Oh, I planted tomatoes in my backyard, or I planted beans," or whatever they did. So we're teaching the children to grow their own food. We're helping the community by giving them food, and people would just come and go. We would see one time we were out planting or harvesting, and actually pulling weeds, and we saw a homeless man standing over, not too far away, just waiting. And I said, he's waiting for us to leave so he can come and eat. So we hurried and left. And sure enough, he helped himself, which just, made us so happy.
That is just terrific, Renee. What an inspiring story. Comes right out of the Bible in that you don't just give a person a fish. You teach that person how to fish.
Exactly.
Michelle Obama is an example of precisely what Renee is talking about, teaching these young people with their participation in the White House garden to grow and use and distribute these vegetables.
Yes, and if we want serious food reform in this country, we have to incorporate an edible education like Renee had just mentioned in our schools. And it needs to be taught at a very early age so that students not only understand where their food comes from, it just doesn't magically appear on the supermarket shelves, but also to understand the natural cycles of life and what grows in their particular region and what does not.
You helped me to recall that in my mother's very small garden, she had a cherry tree, she had a peach tree, and she had a fig tree. And of course, tomatoes. And of course, I would be told to go outside, get up on a little ladder, and pick the ripe fruit. I have been a gardener all my life. So now, moving into a condominium, I'm taking care of flowers
exactly.
and watching others take care of vegetables. And we'll take this email. She says, the only place I have to have a great veggie garden is my front yard. Do you think my community association is going to allow that? Can laws prohibit that kind of use of land?
Certain, especially if you live in a suburban area and there are CCNRs, these covenants, codes, and restrictions, they can be very restrictive on what you can plant in your front yard. But I think people are starting to realize that we need to change.
Darren Nordahl, and his new book is titled Public Produce. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Panama City, Florida. Good morning, Elaine. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is such a blessing to hear in America. I'm delighted.
I'm glad.
My question is, has the government considered the recipients of welfare and food stamps to provide them the opportunity to work in these gardens?
Yes, actually, this is probably the biggest argument why I think it's going to have to be local governments versus federal governments. It is heartening to see that the Obamas have a vegetable garden on the lawn of the White House, but the lunch program and the breakfast program, the WIC program, a lot of people feel that they are ineffective, and one way that we can get better produce to people faster is to have our local governments involved. City Hall will always act faster than Capitol Hill.
Thanks for calling, Elaine. And joining us now by phone from Detroit, Michigan, is Ryan Hertz. He is principal with Ecozoic Detroit, a mission-based community organization. Thanks for joining us, Ryan.
Thank you, Diane.
You might just talk about the need for affordable, healthy food in inner city Detroit.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've been dealing with food security issues in this way for quite a long time. There's been a group, the Detroit Agriculture Network, has been involved in organizing community members to address food security through gardening for right around a decade now. Our organization is a group of activists who work together with community groups to address any issue related to equitable, long-term sustainability of the systems that support human life. So,
and how much land is needed to make a real difference in providing enough food there?
Well, and that was something that I was hoping to talk a little bit about. I think it is important that we grow a lot of our food in the city, and I think Darren made an important point that a lot of farmers markets, that we organize the farmers market in neighborhood. Our farmers market, probably the bulk of the produce that's sold there is coming from outside rural areas. And the reality is, in areas of high poverty, and if we really want to have any serious impact on people's access to nutritious foods, we have to do that, and it's a whole lot better than most of the produce that's available to be to be inviting farmers from rural surrounding areas into the city to sell.
Of course, I would think there are real challenges to people who want to operate these city-owned community gardens, because you're dealing with tons of industrial waste and lead in the soil.
Yeah, and that was another point that I really wanted to make sure to touch on, is that I think, we have quite a bit of poverty to deal with here, and we recognize that it's important that we immediately create access to fresh, nutritious produce for people in the city right now. But in terms of long-term food security for people in the city, it's also really important that we acknowledge that urban landscapes are often very damaged landscapes. It's very important that we have a healthy soil ecology so that in the future there's space to grow land. So while it is important that we grow land on unused, or sorry, that we grow food on unused space, it's also very important that we start thinking about long-term, generations forward. You know, sustainability is not only related to peak oil and energy, and it is important that food's local. It is important that we don't use the energy to move the food further than we need to. But with or without oil or another form of maybe more renewable energy, we will not be able to grow any food or feed any animals, anything, if our soil systems are decimated. So
Ryan Hertz, he is principal with Ecozoic Detroit. It's a mission-based community organization. Thank you so much for joining us, for being a part of our ongoing series on environmental issues.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the ethical questions and controversies surrounding the CIA's covert drone program, in which remotely controlled unmanned planes target terror suspects in Pakistan. We talk with Jane Mayer, who covers national security for The New Yorker and writes about the drone program in the current edition. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. We'll go right back to the phones. Let's go to Mount Ulla, North Carolina. Bill, you're on the air. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Mount Ulla.
Ulla. Mount Ulla.
Ulla.
Okay.
Yes.
Go right ahead, sir.
Well, my suggestion was that actually that churches take up the same type of situation. I know many of the churches in our area have lawns, big lawns, that are not being used except for cutting. So
I think that's a great idea, Bill.
That's an excellent idea, Bill. And you're right, especially our older churches where they were located on large parcels of land have an immense amount of opportunity to grow vegetables and fruit trees. And some actually are doing that.
I was going to ask where.
We have, I've seen a few, especially in the Midwest, actually, throughout Iowa, that realize that not just for their congregation, but as part of community service, an easy way to feed the community.
That's terrific. Thanks for calling. And joining us now by phone from Portland, Oregon, is Mayor Sam Adams. Good morning to you, Mr. Mayor. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
I'm so glad. Portland has had some both different problems and solutions in providing food for its citizens, different from cities like Detroit or Des Moines.
That's right. We have had one of the nation's highest incidents of hunger. And we are working hard on a lot of the types of initiative your other guests have talked about. But I guess I would also add to an additional item we're working on to the conversation, and that is around getting a baseline for the city's needs around food. And it's interesting, most mayors in the United States can, you know, if they ask their staff, they can tell you how much water we consume every day, every week, every month, how much electricity we consume as cities every day, every week, every month. But it is rare for any mayor to be able to, you know, to have a finger on the pulse.
Yeah.
What is our food requirement?
Well, and what is the extent of your food shortage problem? I'm surprised to hear that in a city like Portland, Oregon, there is a food shortage problem.
Well, first off, we try to be very scrupulous about making sure that we're honest in our counting and accounting of people that go hungry. And then we also gear up with the Oregon Food Bank and with, you know, as other cities offering garden plots and even larger agricultural plots for sort of group farming as well. But we try to be very scrupulous in our accounting of hunger locally, and so that with that accurate handle on the situation, we can address it. Working with one of my colleagues on the City Council, Commissioner Nick Fish, for example, I came into office January 1st, and we have a 1,300-person waiting list for community garden plots. And so, as has been mentioned by, you know, Darren and other guests, we are busy looking at all the municipal land, and even I love the idea of church land, which we haven't looked at before, looking at all the available land. And the key there is not only the land, but you have to have water to it.
Of course.
Exactly. So we're working on how do we connect it to water.
Well, and the other question becomes, how do you fund these kinds of programs, especially considering the current economic crisis?
That is a challenge. That is definitely a challenge. But and to also focus to make sure that we're getting plots in the right place. You know, earlier you discussed the food desert, and we're just about done with our inventory of what it means to be a complete neighborhood in the city of Portland, and that includes access to not just food but healthy food. And that, combined with our current efforts to inventory all available land and then finding the resources to get the water to those potential garden plots, that's our priorities right now on this issue.
You've also got something you call the Portland Fruit Tree Project.
We do. This is a great, fantastic grassroots effort that identifies fruit trees on public and private land. And among other things, and the nonprofit cultivates, cares for these trees, harvests them. They have an annual pie bake-off with some of the fruit that they harvest to help fundraise themselves. And we'll be looking to expand that. And one way we're looking to expand that is to offer a greater variety of street trees, and to, in addition to the normal, I should say, I don't know if normal is the right word, but the trees that the city has planted in greatest numbers, we're now mixing in more and more fruit trees.
What kinds of fruits?
Well, we do really well on fruits like figs and pears, more of the cool weather sort of crops, or crops that can take about, you know, 2 months of some intense heat and then lots of rain.
Do you have questions for him, Darren?
No, I do want to point out, though, that Portland, Oregon is probably the exemplar city in regard to looking at public space and growing food on public lands. And they're profiled immensely in the book. And the mayor is absolutely right. It's tough to get an accurate count on how many hungry people you have in your cities. And it's more than I think mayors estimate. Hmm. And one way is to just talk to the food banks. The food banks have a pretty good idea on how many people are hungry in their community.
And finally, Mayor Adams, what do you do when there's no fruit available? There are no veggies available. Nothing is growing because the land is dormant.
Well, just 2 weeks ago, we turned over to Mercy Corps, that normally does international work, to manage a plot of land that has been sitting dormant that was acquired by our sewer agency to potentially mitigate floods. And as Darren talked about, as part of our ongoing inventorying effort, that now is going to be turned over to a group of recent immigrants to the city. So we're always looking. And we've got a great partnership with the Water Bureau. We also want to show folks that you can do a lot with a little piece of ground. So the front yard of City Hall, we turned into a garden. This summer, we harvested 250 pounds of produce that was in partnership with a local nonprofit shelter. So we're also trying to walk our own talk in addition to planting more city fruit trees in addition to finding more land and hooking them up to water. We turned over City Hall to fruit. And I would tell you at the outset, people were like, you know, this is such a small amount of land. This is ridiculous. This is like a vanity project. But 250 pounds of food and involving folks in growing their own food, it ended up getting a lot of public attention because hopefully inspired folks to, you know, hey, even your planting strip can be turned into food.
What a great good news story. Thank you so much for being with us, Mayor Sam Adams.
Thank you, Diane.
Portland, Oregon. We'll talk to you again.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's go now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Ben. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
I am both a culinary student and a small-scale caterer, and I'm very interested in local foods. But for people who live in sort of what is known as the Rust Belt and parts of the industrial Midwest, where, you know, unused urban land, and because of the industrial activity that's gone on there over the last 150 years, how do urban farmers address issues of pollution or land that might be contaminated?
Darren.
Yeah, and that's an excellent question, and it's a question that keeps resurfacing. There are portions of the city that are highly contaminated, and usually with lead. And there actually are many ways to mitigate and remediate lead contamination in the soil.
How long does it take?
A long time.
That's what I thought.
Lead moves very little in the soil. They're now experimenting with growing mustard and removing it. But the surest way is to either A, bring in topsoil and grow all your vegetables on fresh land, or find a clean site. And there are plenty of clean sites throughout the city.
Darren Nordahl, his new book is titled Public Produce, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hi there, Pamela. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Diane.
How are you? Good, thanks.
Thank you, and I'm thrilled to hear about your book, and have been a proponent of that for years. I have a question. I so appreciate the words from the former educator. I also am in education, but I struggle with this. I had once been in Guatemala and worked in orphanages there, and on the most arid of lands, grew everything that possibly could be grown. But with the enthusiasm of the students, you know, even though they were, you know, orphanages, et cetera. However, when I began it in a local inner city nearby district, I was met with this. And a lot of the students were saying, Mrs. Price, why should we grow a garden when we get, you know, we get all the free food we want at lunch? And, you know, we get as much as we want and it's always there. And it struck me for a second, their lack of appreciation. I then further found out, and this is perhaps you can assist me with this, once a student touches, per se, a carton of milk, and they may take two or three cartons, and they only drink one. Once they're touched, unopened, they're considered disposable. So I'm on the end of watching almost in one day 850 or more unused, unopened cartons of milk thrown out, and a variety of also fresh vegetables that have been cooked and prepared for the students. But this lack of appreciation in that it's there, I can get all I want, you know, it's free, it doesn't matter. How does one counteract that?
And that is difficult. Most of the food they're getting at their lunches, though, I would argue, is chicken nuggets and tater tots.
Yeah.
And this is a way for them to actually get the food they need. And it is going to be difficult to get that fresh produce grown outside their schools, maybe in their lunch programs. But it is available for them on their way to school and home from school. And it teaches them about food and where food comes from.
And, of course, there are lots of questions about how can I get my city started.
And it all comes from the people lobbying their elected officials. It is a top-down approach that I'm arguing for. Usually the communities had to beg and plead just to have the elected officials allow them to grow a community garden on an underutilized portion of their park. Now what we're seeing is the top brass of the city, mayors, actually implementing these programs and hiring staff to make sure that they are managed and maintained well.
Have you talked with anyone here in Washington about that?
I have not talked to anyone in Washington. There seems to be a federal focus here in this city and not so much a local focus.
Here's an email from Julia. She said, I recently discussed with my godmother, who turned 80 this year, about the history she had experienced in life. We discussed World War II and how everyone was asked to do their part. She spoke of victory gardens where people would forego a lawn to grow their family's vegetables. Could we possibly learn from history?
20 million small gardens provided 40% of the nation's fresh vegetables during World War II. And I think that is an admirable goal that we should strive for, and obviously an achievable one because it has been done before.
So you're not talking about pipe dreams here, Darren?
I'm not talking about a pipe dream. I'm hopefully talking about something that is somewhat idealistic but eminently achievable.
And you've seen it achieved in cities around the
country.
And
it's nascent right now. It's not particularly newsworthy. It's hard to find these cities that are starting these programs, but they're all over the country, and they are starting, and they're experiencing great success.
All right, to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane.
Hi.
Good morning,
there.
Good morning. I wanted to share a little bit about what we're doing in St. Louis. I'm in the community college system, and I'm actually about 7 minutes away before I teach my nutrition class. And some of the things that we're doing to support our communities, I'm spearheading a program in sustainability, you know, kind of broad-based, but I'm also focusing on, you know, concrete activities that our students can do, such as looking at their household utilization, collecting their rainwater, recycling their food to help till the soil and doing their own gardening, and then reaching out to the local schools also to do that, and looking at how we can get involved in the local politics and get community gardening going. And so I just first wanted to share that. And then I've got a couple of questions. Has anybody ever looked at using malls and hospitals and their roofs for rooftop gardens?
Well, hospitals in particular, parking lots. Kaiser Permanente, one of the largest healthcare providers in the nation, started in Oakland where a physician set up a farmer's market on the parking lot. And it was met with such huge success that now almost all Kaiser Permanente facilities from Georgia to Hawaii have farmer's markets set up in their parking lots.
And what are they growing? What are they bringing?
They're bringing in fresh fruits, local fruits and vegetables from around the area as a way of preventative medicine, really. There's nothing more important to American society's health than what you eat every day.
You know, it's interesting because I don't mean to be too critical, but sometimes the food inside the hospital is not as good.
I was not going to say that.
I know. But, you know, you have to think
you're right. Yes.
That with that, with those farmers markets right out there in front, they ought to be able to make use of that good, nutritious,
exactly,
and make it into beautiful food. Darren Nordahl, I must say, I congratulate you not only for bringing all this to our attention, but for bringing to all of us a good news story. We hear so many stories that drag us down. This is a true good news story. I'm so glad you've brought it to us as part of our series on the environment.
Thank you, Diane.
The book is titled Public Produce, The New Urban Agriculture. Darren Nordahl is the author, and that's spelled N-O-R-D-A-H-L. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.